the attack, Foster, Dulles, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff met to consider their military plans. They all agreed if the Communist Chinese attacked Quemoy in an amphibious landing, the United States would drop several small atomic weapons, which they defined as 7 to 10 kiloton bombs, on Chinese airfields and military staging grounds. A 10 kiloton bomb would create about two-thirds the explosive power of the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. The Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army, General Maxwell Taylor, said such nuclear weapons were the only way to do the job, in order to avoid a protracted Korea-type conflict. The Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Nathan Twining, agreed, casually admitting he could not understand the public horror at the idea of using nuclear weapons. The military chiefs knew that some Asian countries, like Japan, would recoil at the use of atomic bombs on China, but they insisted that the loss of influence among such allies was a smaller price to pay than the huge loss of world prestige that would occur if America failed to live up to its word and crumpled under communist pressure. Dulles, evidently much enthused by the iron-fisted determination of the military chiefs, advised the president that the Chinese assault on Quemoy was part of a broader plan to liquidate Chiang's nationalists on Taiwan, and that the United States must be prepared to use nuclear weapons in a war with China. If we will not use them when the chips are down because of adverse world opinion, we must revise our defense setup. The second choice, leaving Quemoy to its fate, struck Dulles as far more dangerous than hitting China with atom bombs. He argued, if we do give up the islands, Chiang is finished. He would be militarily weakened and possibly overthrown by neutralist elements inside Taiwan. Very soon the Pacific would become a communist lake, and all the wobbly Asian nations such as the Philippines and Japan would make their peace with their new communist masters in Beijing. Those allies had become symbols of American resolve to wage the Cold War. The problem is primarily one of psychology, Dulles explained to Prime Minister Macmillan, and what would look like a retreat before the new, tough, and arrogant probing of the communists. If the United States seems afraid and loses face in any way, the consequences will be far-reaching, extending from Vietnam in the south to Japan and Korea in the north. The domino theory never had a clearer explanation. Eisenhower has often been criticized for indecision and a tendency to postpone and prevaricate, but never was there a more suitable moment for his particular kind of strategic patience than in the second Taiwan Straits crisis of September 1958. He refused to accept the problem as Dulles and his military advisors framed it. He rejected the stark choice between nuclear war and appeasement. There had to be a third choice, even if it meant making no choice at all. And so he waited. Eisenhower did not want to overreact to Mao's dangerous gamesmanship. He instructed his advisers that unless a much bigger and direct threat to Taiwan emerged, they should probably hold back on nuclear measures. The offshore islands were unnecessary to defend Taiwan, he reiterated, and he would be happy to cut a deal in which Chiang left them all together in exchange for some kind of acceptance by Mao of the status quo in Taiwan. Ike told the Secretary of Defense, Neil McElroy, that Dulles tends to take a somewhat stiffer view of things. But Eisenhower had no use for such inflexibility. It is not adequate simply to say that we will stand on Quemoy and Matsu. We must move beyond that. He would not allow the offshore islands to draw America into war. Instead, he made a few carefully calculated moves. He reinforced Taiwan's supply of fighter aircraft and provided them with new Sidewinder missiles. He transferred a regiment of Nike anti-aircraft missiles to Taiwan and gave the Nationalists powerful artillery pieces. He ordered the 7th Fleet to provide convoy cover, so that supply ships from Taiwan could reach Quemoy and resupply the besieged garrison there. This proved tricky and dangerous, as there were many soldiers and civilians to feed on Quemoy. But the Navy accomplished the task. At the same time, Eisenhower insisted that Chiang do nothing to trigger a full-scale war, like bombing airfields on the mainland of China. In short, Ike figured he could wait out the communist provocation, resupply the soldiers on Quemoy, and avoid either war or retreat. It was a gamble, and it worked. On October 6th, after 6 weeks of intensive shelling, Mao announced a one-week moratorium on the artillery attacks, a pause that stretched on for a few more weeks until the crisis had passed. Quemoy remained under Taiwan's control, as it does today. No small atomic bombs were dropped. America did not lose face in Asia. Chiang did not attack the mainland, though he continued to fume about insufficiently firm American support. Eisenhower's strategy of patience paid off. He restrained his generals and his Secretary of State, calmed his allies, and showed that the United States would not be bullied. It was a quiet and terribly important victory for the president. But of course, it was not the kind of victory that played well on the home stage. The press attacked Eisenhower and Dulles mercilessly, first for allowing the United States to be manipulated by Chiang into such a dangerous predicament, and then for being insufficiently bold in standing by the nationalist leader in his hour of need. Walter Lippmann wrote a dozen columns during the six-week-long crisis in which he flayed the administration for strategic incoherence and incompetence. "There is no policy on the offshore islands," he asserted, "only a wager that the Chinese won't do anything too rash." He described the administration as paralyzed, at a dead end, and embarrassing. Joseph Alsop, not to be outdone, actually rushed to Taiwan in the midst of the crisis and published no fewer than 17 smoldering essays of invective against the Eisenhower administration. He used the crisis to bash Ike for failing to keep a sufficiently robust naval and military presence in Asia, and for hesitating in the face of communist aggression. Such was the verdict of the pundits. The domestic politics of the second Taiwan Straits crisis were indeed disastrous for the president. Democrats repackaged Eisenhower's policy of restraint and patience as incoherence and indecision. "We have teetered constantly on the brink of foreign wars no American wants or could even explain," commented Senator Kennedy, a future architect of America's war in Vietnam. Presidential aspirants Averill Harriman and Hubert Humphrey, as well as leading Senate Democrats Mike Mansfield, William Fulbright, and Theodore Francis Green, excoriated Eisenhower's brinkmanship. Little did they know that Eisenhower was the one firmly pulling on the reins of restraint, guiding the horses of war away from the abyss. 9. What a year it had been. Since September 1957, when the bitter confrontation erupted in Little Rock and the recession began, Eisenhower had known nothing but trouble. The launch of Sputnik in October, a stroke in November, the embarrassing congressional probe into the missile programs that ran until January 1958, the much-publicized failures of American test rockets on their launching pads, contrasting with the success of the Soviets' Sputnik 3 in May 1958, and now, in July and August, two foreign entanglements that seemed to many Americans as ill-conceived as they were dangerous. Throw into that depressing litany the most damaging and least truthful criticism of all, namely the opening up of a vast and threatening missile gap, the result of Ike's supposedly complacent leadership. Without a doubt, the period from September 1957 to November 1958 marks Eisenhower's most troubled year in office. Two personal losses added anguish to the year. His longtime chief of staff, Sherman Adams, resigned in September 1958. Adams had been with Eisenhower from the first snowy days in New Hampshire in 1952 and served the president with tenacity and ferocious loyalty. He was respected and feared in Washington and little liked, earning the nickname the Abominable No Man. Eisenhower relied on him enormously. But in June, the House of Representatives began an inquiry into accusations that Adams had accepted gifts from a Boston rug merchant named Bernard Goldfein, who was under investigation by the Federal Trade Commission. Adams had indeed accepted an expensive vicuña coat, an oriental carpet, and free hotel accommodations from Goldfein, though he denied exerting any pressure on the FTC on Goldfein's behalf. The scandal grew and became a threat to the administration's record of incorruptibility. Adams resigned on September 22nd and returned to his native New Hampshire. Eisenhower felt Adams had been wronged. "Nothing that has occurred has had a more depressive effect on my normal buoyancy and optimism than has the virulent, sustained, demagogic attacks made upon him," he wrote to a mutual friend. In that difficult autumn, Eisenhower also lost one of his oldest friends. On November 2, 1958, following a long illness, Swede Hazlitt died. They had known each other since their school days, when Eisenhower, strong and athletic, had stood up for Swede on the playground against a neighborhood tough. "Why don't you try that on me?" he said to the bully, who skulked away. They were fast friends from that day on. Hazlitt had kept up an extraordinary correspondence with Eisenhower, writing to him regularly in what might be called the unadorned voice of the everyman. In dozens upon dozens of letters, Hazlitt expressed opinions on matters from the Supreme Court to race relations, foreign policy, and taxes. Eisenhower often responded at length, and his letters form a crucial body of material for historians. "I can never quite tell you what Swede meant to me," Eisenhower wrote to Swede's wife, Ibby. "While I am glad for his sake that he suffers no longer, his passing leaves a permanent void in my life." The coup de grace in this troubled year came on November 4, 1958, just 2 years after Eisenhower's triumphant re-election. On that day, the midterm congressional elections delivered a huge defeat to the Republicans and implicitly to the president himself. The Democrats already controlled both houses of Congress, but they dramatically widened their lead. In the Senate, which the Democrats had held by a narrow margin for the previous 4 years, the Republicans lost a whopping 13 seats, giving Democrats a 30-seat advantage. In the House, 48 Republicans lost their re-election bids, and the Democrats now enjoyed a 130-seat cushion. It was an unmitigated rout. Nixon, who had given speeches across the country during the campaign, recalled it as "one of the most depressing election nights I have ever known." What explains this decisive rebuke from the voters? Eisenhower blamed the seeming desire of the people of our country to depend more and more upon government. "They do not seem to understand that more governmental assistance inevitably means more governmental control." But the problems went deeper than that. The main explanation lay in the economic troubles the country faced. Most of the losses came in states with high unemployment. People were hurting, and they sent a message. More broadly, Eisenhower in 1958 lost control of the political narrative of his own presidency. Peace, prosperity, security, and small government, these had been the watchwords of Eisenhower's modern republicanism. By late 1958, these looked like hollow phrases. The horizon was clouded by threats of war, the economy sputtered, claims of a missile gap suggested a weak national defense, and both taxes and spending remained high. In retrospect, we can see that Eisenhower governed wisely and well in 1958. He responded thoughtfully to the Sputnik crisis and once again stamped out the flames of war in Asia. But his opponents described him as a failure. They painted a portrait of an America that had faltered economically, had fallen behind in the missile race, had let its military might wane, had stumbled over the racial crisis in the South, and had surrendered the mantle of leadership on the world stage. To his critics, Eisenhower looked out of touch, indecisive, and adrift. In the final 2 years of his presidency, Eisenhower would have to find an effective way to rebut this criticism. The stakes were enormous. His place in history was at risk. Chapter 16. Contending with Khrushchev. "We don't escape war by surrendering on the installment plan." 1. Soon after the disastrous midterm elections of 1958, Eisenhower retreated to Augusta and the cocoon of his favorite golf club. He played golf every day for 2 weeks, usually scoring about 90 and betting with his playing partners on every game. He also huddled with his advisors and staff to discuss the future. He and his party had suffered a bad beating at the polls, a defeat that followed a rough 2 years for the administration. How could Eisenhower revive his flagging presidency? As he surveyed the domestic political scene and considered the 2-to-1 advantage the Democrats enjoyed over Republicans in Congress, Eisenhower knew that he could not count on any major legislative victories. In fact, he expected nothing but trouble from Congress. In his first post-election press conference, he pledged to fight, as hard as I know how, any proposals from the Democrats for greater spending. Not exactly a message of conciliation. But simply halting Democratic activity and wielding a veto was no way for the president to recover his momentum. If he was going to restore luster and sparkle to his tarnished second term, he needed something that would fire up the national imagination. Eisenhower had hoped he might be able to deliver a major agreement with the Soviets in the matter of nuclear weapons testing. Anxieties about nuclear fallout, a new word in the American vocabulary, reached a crescendo in 1958, as scientific studies began to show the dangerous health effects of radioactivity on humans. In February 1958, Edward Teller and the Nobel laureate Linus Pauling held a televised debate on the consequences of fallout, with Teller poo-pooing the matter and Pauling calling for an end to nuclear tests. In August, a United Nations scientific committee released a damning report on the effects of nuclear weapons testing, stirring a public debate about the presence of the radioactive isotope strontium-90 in the nation's food supply. The public had reason to worry. In 1957 and 1958, the Defense Department had been setting off nuclear weapons in the Nevada desert at an unprecedented rate, 28 tests in July 1957 and 36 more in October 1958. Many of the test bombs were carried into the atmosphere by balloons, thus ensuring wide broadcasting of radioactive particles. The United States and the USSR began exploratory talks in summer 1958 about an atmospheric test ban treaty, and in response to growing public pressure, Eisenhower announced a one-year moratorium on such tests on October 31st. But by the end of the year, talks with the Soviets had bogged down, and no progress seemed likely. What other initiatives might bring Eisenhower a victory? As he left for Augusta on November 20th, he wrote a letter to his former speechwriter, Emmett Hughes, with an idea that might spark national enthusiasm. He wanted to center greater attention in our country, and so far as possible in the free world, on the predominant influence of spiritual values in our lives. He yearned to transcend the stale arguments in the freedom-communist struggle, as he called it. We have been tending too much toward the material. We have too much thought of bombs and machines and gadgets as the arsenal of our national and cultural strength. He wondered if there was some way to reach out to heads of state around the world and persuade them to join in a great affirmation of the importance of religion and faith in world affairs. Hughes was skeptical. Although he couched his criticism elegantly, he asserted that mere rhetoric and exhortation would do little to impact world affairs. If Eisenhower wanted results, he would have to take action. A good way to damage a principle or ideal is to affirm it passionately, then fail to give it true testimony indeed. Besides, Hughes wondered, what would Secretary Dulles say about religious and pacific appeal to the world? Not surprisingly, the stern and cagey Dulles snuffed out the idea. He had no interest in a heartfelt but vague call to spiritual uplift. That would only suggest irresolution and weakness in the Cold War contest. Yet Eisenhower needed something bold to restore public faith in his leadership. In Augusta, he held long discussions with Jim Haggerty, his press secretary and confidant. Eager that Ike should avoid looking like a lame duck in his last years in office, Haggerty urged Eisenhower to adopt the role of Tribune of the People, going over the head of the partisan Congress and speaking out on matters of national and global importance. In addition to holding the line on spending and denouncing the sheer nonsense about American failures in the missile race, Ike had a unique opportunity to reestablish his prestige by undertaking visible and constructive measures on the world stage. It was time for a globe-trotting campaign of personal diplomacy. "Americans know," Haggerty asserted in a long memo to Eisenhower, "that if anyone in our nation can keep the world at peace, it is you. They, like all peoples of the world, look to the president as the one individual who can contribute the most to keeping the peace." It was time to push aside the State Department and make Eisenhower the spokesman of American interests on the world stage. The president should appear more frequently at the United Nations and speak the language of goodwill. He should launch a major program of international travel to raise his profile and spread the gospel of peace and understanding in the developing world. India, Pakistan, Southeast Asia, Latin America, Europe, Africa, and maybe even the USSR. Eisenhower should set out to visit all of them and wave high the flag of peace. And he should seek out direct contact with the Soviet leaders through international summits where global crises could be settled. Haggerty felt much good could come from meeting with Khrushchev and that the initiative should come from Eisenhower. Why not propose it ourselves on our terms, rather than end up eventually as reluctant participants in a meeting which the Soviets will herald as a meeting for peace? These personal gestures, which could not be constrained by a feisty partisan Congress, might generate enthusiasm for the president and his party at home, and might also open the way to a genuine East-West peace agreement before Eisenhower left office. Accompanied by monthly radio and television speeches by the president, these trips and summits would once again place Eisenhower in the forefront of world affairs. If he could ease or even end the Cold War in his final years, Eisenhower's place in history as a champion of peace would be forever secure. Haggerty urged him to seize the moment and turn the coming 2 years to advantage for the president, the United States, indeed for the entire world. 2. As he mused about these various initiatives, however, Ike got some disturbing news that seemed sure to dash his hopes for a new beginning in U.S.-Soviet relations. On November 27, 1958, sitting in rumpled golf togs in a small office above the pro shop at Augusta National, Eisenhower heard a report from his son and aide, Major John Eisenhower, who had just flown in from Washington to brief him. Khrushchev had decided to pick a fight over the city of Berlin, thus triggering a crisis that would loom over the rest of Eisenhower's presidency and shape the Cold War for decades. At the close of World War II, Germany was divided into four zones of occupation. The United States, Britain, France, and the Soviet Union each acted as the sovereign authority in their zone. The arrangement was supposed to be temporary, but it soon became permanent. In 1949, the Western powers merged their zones into a single entity that became the Federal Republic of Germany, or West Germany. The Soviets transformed their occupation zone into the German Democratic Republic, or East Germany. Because the four occupying powers never signed a peace treaty with Germany, these two successors to Hitler's Reich were not legally sovereign, and would not be until 1990. Yet they looked and acted like fully functioning states. West Germany, led by the staunchly anti-communist Christian Democrat Konrad Adenauer, joined NATO in 1955. East Germany became a member of the Communist Bloc Alliance, the Warsaw Pact. Odd though it seemed, dividing Germany in two provided a Solomonic solution. It was far better than fighting another war. One major irritant remained. Berlin. Located deep inside East Germany, the former capital of the Reich was also subdivided into four occupation zones. By international agreement, U.S., British, and French soldiers and diplomats lived and worked in Berlin and could move freely across the city. Furthermore, they could travel to Berlin across East German territory by road, rail, and airplane from West Germany. And the Western powers scrupulously insisted that their access into the occupied capital city never be impeded. Stalin, in 1948, had tested Western resolve by imposing a blockade of Berlin, halting all road and rail travel into the city. Loath to shoot down Allied airplanes, which would have been an act of war, Stalin left the air bridge open, and the Western states broke the year-long blockade by airlifting millions of tons of supplies into Berlin. It was an enormous propaganda victory for the West, and only heightened their determination never to leave Berlin under duress. To the East Germans, the presence of a large and distinctly capitalist foreign occupation force inside their own territory became intolerable. They declared Berlin the capital city of the German Democratic Republic. But what kind of nation would allow its capital city to be occupied by foreigners, and foreign soldiers, no less? The East Germans put constant pressure on the Soviets to resolve the nagging and embarrassing problem of Berlin. They wanted to control the city and expel the Western powers. Would Moscow help them? Khrushchev gave his answer in a formal ultimatum on November 27, 1958. He demanded the Western powers sign a peace treaty with East Germany, acknowledge its full sovereignty, and leave Berlin. If they did not do so in 6 months, that is by May 27, 1959, the Soviet Union would turn over its occupation zone in Berlin to the East Germans, forcing the Western powers to negotiate directly with the East Germans over access to the isolated city. Khrushchev's ultimatum pointed a threatening dagger right at one of the most sensitive spots of the Cold War. Why did he do it? The explanation lies in Khrushchev's personality and his peculiar way of thinking about world politics. Khrushchev was a true believer in the ideology of communism. He gloried in its muscular, forward-looking optimism, its promises of rapid industrialization and perfect equality among workers. He felt certain that the USSR and the world communist movement, with its vast supply of manpower and natural resources, could outproduce and outlast the crooked, rotten capitalist world in an open competition. This belief inspired his famous taunt to a roomful of Western ambassadors at a meeting in 1956, "Whether you like it or not, history is on our side. We will bury you." An aggressive, garrulous, argumentative man, Khrushchev relished these kinds of verbal provocations. He operated on bluff, bluster, and biting tirades. He boasted of Soviet military power, hoping to intimidate his enemies. With the October 1957 launch of Sputnik, his rhetorical boasts reached new heights. He bragged about cranking out missiles like sausages and threatened to strike any nation that blocked the Soviet Union's path. For all his bravado, Khrushchev did not want war. Though his tactics were clumsy and counterproductive, he hoped for a period of stability in world affairs so that Soviet industry and science could continue their remarkable progress, demonstrating the superiority of the communist system. At the same time, he could never appear complacent. He was the leader, after all, not just of the Soviet Union, but of the entire communist world. And for the world's radicals, the anti-colonial nationalists, the rebel fighters and leftist prophets in Latin America, Africa, and Asia, he needed to demonstrate his zeal for global revolution. Thus his dilemma. He wanted to ease the Cold War with America and lower its cost, yet he also wanted to benefit from the prestige of leading an assault on the capitalist imperialist West. Khrushchev was caught in a contradiction of his own making. His ultimatum on Berlin in November 1958 sprang from these competing pressures. He hoped to gain prestige within the communist bloc by standing up for his East German ally, poking his finger in the chest of Western leaders, and wresting full control of Berlin from the capitalists. Yet he privately hoped that his move would open up a round of high-level negotiations with the United States that might lead to a broad settlement of the German problem and even of the Cold War. It was a terrific gamble. If it worked, he would secure his place as the great leader who built a firm foundation for Soviet success. But if Eisenhower felt directly threatened by this move on Berlin, Khrushchev might trigger World War III. Eisenhower reacted to Khrushchev's declaration on Berlin with circumspection. He understood that this defiant outpost of Western power deep inside the communist bloc irritated the Soviets. He also knew the city could not be defended militarily if communist forces chose to seize it. He described the West Berliners as little more than a group of hostages in the hands of the Soviet, and he privately regretted that the United States had pledged its honor to defend them. He had advised against a joint international occupation of the city in 1945, and he now felt vindicated. Discussing the matter with his advisors, he called the Western position in Berlin untenable and illogical. He compared the predicament to Quemoy, where the United States had committed itself to defend a strategically useless and vulnerable citadel. Nonetheless, there was no question of retreating under pressure. The United States would stand firm, he said simply. If the Russians want war over Berlin, they can have it. That is not, however, what the Soviets wanted, as Eisenhower soon learned. On December 1st, Khrushchev met with Senator Hubert Humphrey, who was on a congressional visit to Moscow. Khrushchev devoted a full day to the senator, eager for him to return home with a clear message. In a session lasting over 8 hours, Khrushchev's emotions, as usual, swung between bellicose and cordial. Humphrey recalled that the Soviet leader tried to frighten me with talk of Soviet missile strength, but insisted later, there will never be a war. Khrushchev struck Humphrey as sincere but impulsive, a man with no time to waste. Humphrey observed Khrushchev's mixture of pride, aggression, and insecurity, and reported to the State Department what he had learned. Khrushchev described Berlin as a thorn, a cancer, a bone in my throat. If it could be removed, peace would soon follow. Berlin, he suggested, should be turned into a free city and perhaps turned over to the United Nations. It could be neutralized as Austria had been. He also tossed out ideas for the prompt reunification of East and West Germany as one neutral nation. Spluttering and angry one moment, congenial the next, Khrushchev told Humphrey, "I like President Eisenhower. We want no evil to the U.S. or to free Berlin. You must assure the president of this. Only a madman or a fool," Khrushchev insisted, "would think of war between the superpowers." These observations clearly influenced Eisenhower, since they squared with his own belief that the USSR did not want to fight over Berlin. In sessions with his advisors in December and January, Eisenhower developed the strategy he would adopt toward Khrushchev. He would make it absolutely clear that the United States would not leave Berlin or allow any part of Berlin to come under the control of the East Germans. Using a poker analogy, he said there should be no ambiguity about America's position. In order to avoid beginning with the white chips and working our way up to the blue, we should place them on notice that our whole stack is in play. The United States would respond in a friendly tone, however, and encourage negotiations. Eisenhower thought the foreign ministers of the four occupying powers should meet and discuss German matters, giving Khrushchev a means to save face and quietly back down. Vice President Nixon, prophetically as it turned out, thought that perhaps what Khrushchev really wanted was a summit meeting with Eisenhower as a way to bolster his own prestige. If so, saber-rattling over Berlin seemed an awkward way to ask for it. Reich called the Berlin problem a can of worms, but his usual inclination toward patience and moderation paid dividends here. He rejected the kind of provocative actions that the Joint Chiefs of Staff seemed to favor, such as driving a heavily armed convoy down the Autobahn and daring the Russians to stop it. I could have none of that. He resented Soviet tactics, but he would much prefer talking to fighting. Arranging a meeting of the foreign ministers took a great deal of haggling and delicate maneuvering, and it fell to Harold Macmillan to speed things up. Macmillan had risen to prime minister in early 1957, taking over from the disgraced Anthony Eden. The Conservative Party had been badly tarnished by the Suez debacle, and Macmillan needed to notch a success to restore public confidence in the Tories. He hoped that he could improve his standing at home by playing the honest broker, a man who could ease the Berlin crisis, first by getting a foreign ministers' conference underway, and then by arranging a great summit meeting of Khrushchev, Eisenhower, the newly installed French President Charles de Gaulle, and himself. A high-visibility summit that eased the anxieties of the Cold War could deliver a great political boost to McMillan and his conservatives and pave the way to a general election victory in the fall of 1959. In late February 1959, McMillan, full of hope, traveled to Moscow to sound out the Soviets. The trip began well enough as Khrushchev plied his British guests with caviar, salmon, excellent vodka, Russian brandy, ballet performances, and long late-night suppers. But then McMillan discovered what all the other Westerners who engaged with Khrushchev learned. There were two Nikitas. The first was a rational statesman ready to talk about peace, arms control, and coexistence. The other was the communist zealot, the prosecutor, the brawler who threw angry punches in every direction. After three inconsequential days of easy conversations and liquid lunches, Khrushchev gave a menacing speech, denouncing the Western powers for blocking progress on unifying Germany and resolving the Berlin matter. The idea of a foreign minister's meeting was a stalling tactic, he said, a sign that the Western states had no desire to solve their differences. He wanted action and demanded the great powers respond to his demands. McMillan, deeply shocked by this mercurial behavior, told Khrushchev at the tail end of a long and alcohol-fueled luncheon, "If you try to threaten us in any way, you will create the Third World War, because we shall not give in, nor will the Americans." At this, Khrushchev leaped to his feet and shouted, "You have insulted me," and stormed out. That evening, Khrushchev mocked the failed British invasion of Egypt and bullied McMillan. He meant to have his way over Berlin, he said, whatever the Western nations did. Khrushchev then abandoned his guest, letting him visit the country like a wayward tourist and paying him little heed. McMillan's mission looked like an epic failure. At one point he collapsed physically and had to be hauled off to bed by his staff. This rebuff from the ever-unpredictable Khrushchev highlighted the real risks of personal diplomacy. And then, true to his nature, Khrushchev tried to salve the wounds he had inflicted on the British Prime Minister. At the very end of McMillan's visit, Khrushchev quite suddenly agreed to the foreign minister's meeting as a stepping stone to a summit of world leaders. He also withdrew his six-month clock for the Berlin ultimatum he had issued in November. McMillan could go back to London with some good news. The Soviets would negotiate a way out of the Berlin crisis. Having battered and bullied McMillan and demonstrated his willingness to fight, Khrushchev now seemed happy to offer an olive branch. He had displayed his unique, if crude, negotiating style, which began with shouting and verbal assaults, and proceeded toward compromise. 3. Eisenhower and Foster Dulles observed McMillan's Soviet diplomacy with growing dismay. They were appalled at the Englishman's willingness to put up with Khrushchev's bullying, a cardinal sin in the prestige-centered Cold War. Eisenhower wondered how long Britain needs to be slapped in the face before it stood up to this sneering, ill-mannered man. "I told his chief advisers and congressional leaders that he would never tolerate that kind of treatment." The Soviets respected only firmness and strength. Resorting again to a poker analogy, he said the communists always bluffed big, but then backed off. "The question is whether we have the nerve to push our chips into the pot." Eisenhower had no hesitation, since appeasement means disaster. "But if we stand firm, the Soviets will back down." A world-class poker player, Ike knew how to read his opponents. This determination to defy Soviet bullying and never tolerate the slightest sign of disrespect explains the very tense and emotional argument between Eisenhower and McMillan in late March, when the Prime Minister came to Washington for private consultations. McMillan arrived expecting congratulations for having gotten Khrushchev to agree to negotiation instead of war over Berlin. Instead, he found his American friends cool indeed. Eisenhower took McMillan to Camp David for the weekend of March 20th to 21st, and in the brisk spring air of the Catoctin Mountains, the two men had a serious and tough exchange. Macmillan believed he was on the cusp of winning a great coup, a summit meeting of leaders to discuss Germany. But he found that Eisenhower deeply resented Macmillan's effort to manipulate the United States into agreeing to talks in response to Soviet threats. "I told Macmillan that he would not go to a meeting under circumstances which made it appear that he had his hat in his hand. If the foreign ministers met first and made serious progress on the issues of Berlin, German unification, disarmament, and so on, then a summit could be arranged. But until the Soviets showed good faith and a willingness to compromise, he would hear no talk of a summit." Ike's stubborn attitude shattered Macmillan. All the work he had done appeared to be in jeopardy. He said that World War I broke out in 1914 because of the failures of the leaders of that era to meet and talk. Britain had then paid a terrible price and lost 1 million young men. Macmillan himself had fought in France and been wounded 3 times. To that, Eisenhower gave a sharp rejoinder. On the eve of World War II, the world leaders had met at Munich, and those discussions had done nothing to avoid war. Invoking a dreaded legacy of appeasement, Eisenhower would not be associated with any deal that came as a result of a threat. Macmillan said surely negotiation was better than nuclear war. Eisenhower replied that he would not surrender to blackmail. He would not be dragooned by Soviet threats and compelled to parley. "We don't escape war by surrendering on the installment plan," said the president. Though under pressure, he refused to bend. Macmillan, deflated and mournful, retreated to his woodsy cabin for the night. Eisenhower had made his point, and the next morning, Macmillan joined the president in writing a letter to Khrushchev that made the Western position plain. If the foreign ministers, meeting in the summer of 1959, made enough progress on the thorny question of German policy, then a summit meeting might be held in the fall of 1959. On March 30th, Khrushchev accepted the deal. It was a victory for Eisenhower. He would make any future meeting of heads of state dependent upon Soviet good behavior. Both Macmillan and Khrushchev, who wanted to hold a high-level meeting right away, would have to be patient. Ike had re-established his dominance over world affairs and found a way to defuse the Berlin crisis without showing any sign of bending under pressure. He insisted on America's rights in Berlin while leaving open the door to diplomatic discussions. Khrushchev backed down. Ike held firm. Negotiations on Berlin and Germany could move ahead, but on Eisenhower's timetable. This success in lowering the heat over Berlin was clouded by unsettling news. John Foster Dulles was dying. In February, he had gone to Walter Reed for another operation on his cancerous intestines. Anne Whitman noted in her diary that the post-operation report was not good. "The doctors feel there's no use attempting another operation. They are going to give him radiation every other day." The president, who Whitman wrote, did not dwell on death and was rarely shaken by the loss of friends, was hard hit. He even mused about dying and seemed in a funk at the prospect of losing his closest advisor. Eisenhower visited Dulles regularly at Walter Reed, spoke to him on the telephone, and continued to rely on his advice. But Dulles's condition grew steadily worse. On April 11, 1959, his brother Alan told Eisenhower the end seemed near. He was in severe pain, despite heavy use of sedatives, and his spirits have also been declining. Allen then produced a letter for the president containing the Secretary of State's resignation. Foster recommended that he be replaced by Christian A. Herter, his undersecretary, a well-heeled, moderate Republican who had served 10 years in Congress and 5 years as governor of Massachusetts. Herter had been acting secretary during the last stages of Dulles's illness. He was a mild-mannered gentleman, almost crippled by severe arthritis, and not nearly as hawkish as Dulles. Ike seemed reluctant to face the fact that Dulles was dying and said he would not rush to a decision in the matter of replacing him. But Dulles had made up his mind. On April 15th, Eisenhower announced to the press that Dulles would resign his post. On May 24th, he died. Eisenhower took the loss hard. For although he often had to restrain the secretary's more aggressive instincts, he had relied on and trusted Dulles, and knew that Dulles's loyalty was complete and unbending. The two men formed a powerful team, and they could be found together commiserating over a drink at the end of each workday. Without Dulles, and now without Sherman Adams, George Humphrey, Herbert Brownell, Robert Cutler, the whole team that had so cheerfully and optimistically joined Eisenhower in Washington in January 1953, Ike felt alone, his time in office running out. 4. Having eased tensions over Berlin, Eisenhower began quietly to revive his earlier idea about a rapprochement with Moscow, perhaps even involving a trip to the Soviet Union. Naturally, such a trip had to be carefully prepared. It could never appear that Eisenhower was asking to be received by the Soviets as McMillan had done, but if Eisenhower played his cards right, he might get an opportunity to launch his own gesture of personal diplomacy and end his presidency on a high note. Fortunately, a test case soon presented itself. For some time, Nixon, too, had been hoping to make a trip to the Soviet Union. He had already done a great deal of international travel. Much of it was arduous and demanding, as when he traveled 18,000 miles across Africa in the spring of 1957. Some of his travels caused embarrassment, especially his ill-fated eight-nation tour of Latin America in 1958. In most of the nations he visited on that trip, Nixon met with loud opposition, placards, and stone-throwing protesters. In Caracas, Venezuela, his motorcade was attacked by an angry mob wielding lead pipes and stones. Nonetheless, such journeys raised Nixon's international profile, burnishing his credentials for his 1960 presidential run. He thought a trip to Moscow could help him look like a world statesman. The opening of the American National Exhibition in Sokolniki Park in Moscow, slated for midsummer 1959, provided the perfect occasion for Nixon to visit. A common feature of international cultural diplomacy of the 1950s, such exhibitions served as public advertisements for the commercial and technical achievements of the given nation. The Soviet Union was set to open a major display of its own scientific prowess in June in New York City. Nixon saw his opportunity. On April 4, 1959, he discussed the idea of going to Moscow with Foster Dulles as he sat by his bedside in Walter Reed. Dulles gave the trip his blessing, and the president approved as well. 2 weeks later, Eisenhower announced that Nixon would lead a delegation to the USSR to cut the ribbon of the American exhibition. Nixon spent the spring and summer preparing for his trip, devouring briefing books, meeting with officials across Washington, seeking insight from men like Hubert Humphrey, Averell Harriman, and Harold McMillan, all of whom had recently met with Khrushchev. He was determined to make his encounter with Khrushchev a personal success. It soon became clear, though, that Eisenhower did not want to delegate the role of globe-trotting statesman to his vice president. Well before Nixon left for his trip, Eisenhower began to plan an exchange of visits with Khrushchev. Dulles had long opposed any such personal diplomacy on the grounds that a meeting with Khrushchev would help the Soviets more than the United States. But Dulles was no longer by Ike's side, cautioning him about the perils of appeasement. In mid-June, Eisenhower discussed with his advisors and with the British ambassador the tendering of an invitation to Khrushchev to come to the United States. On July 8th, Ike told Christian Herder that, "If we are ever to break the logjam with the Soviets, an exchange of visits might do the trick. We would like to negotiate with the USSR," Ike insisted, "but not with a gun pointed at our head." Herder, less cautious and suspicious than Dulles, cheered the plan. "There is a feeling worldwide," he stated, "that no one in the world other than President Eisenhower would have so much influence in reaching for world peace." At the president's direction, the senior staff now prepared a confidential invitation to Khrushchev. Robert Murphy, the veteran diplomat, approached Frol Kozlov, the Soviet deputy prime minister who was in New York, to preside over the Soviet exhibition and asked him to convey a message to Khrushchev in the strictest confidence. Murphy passed Kozlov a sealed envelope containing an invitation from Eisenhower. The visit, Eisenhower wrote, would be merely a personal discussion, not a negotiation, at the presidential retreat, Camp David, and could include a tour of the United States. The president expressed his hope that such a meeting would breathe new life into the ongoing discussions over Germany and arms control, and pave the way to a larger summit of world leaders. Khrushchev received the invitation with joy, according to his son, Sergei. He was flattered. He also saw the political advantages of being treated as an equal of the United States. On July 21st, the day before Nixon departed on his journey to Moscow, the Soviet ambassador brought to the White House Khrushchev's eager reply. He accepted the invitation and returned the compliment by asking Eisenhower to be his guest in the Soviet Union. They agreed to keep the invitations quiet until after Nixon had completed his trip. Eisenhower and Khrushchev, each in his own way, needed this high-profile meeting of great power leaders. It would augment their personal prestige, ease the Cold War, and quite possibly cement their respective legacies. By the time Nixon landed in Moscow on July 23, 1959, for his tour of the USSR, his trip had become little more than a curtain raiser for the historic Khrushchev-Eisenhower encounter. Nixon made the most of his moment on the world stage. He first met with Khrushchev in the Kremlin on July 24th, where the Soviet leader began their conversation by vehemently criticizing the passage by Congress of a law proclaiming the third week in July Captive Nations Week, a piece of Cold War posturing that denounced the Soviet subjugation of Eastern Europe and the suppression of religious and political freedom. Nixon tried to explain that Congress was independent of the executive, but Khrushchev saw the resolution as provocative propaganda. Khrushchev remained in an argumentative mood for most of the 10-day visit. When Nixon toured the American exhibit in Moscow with Khrushchev at his side, the two men held an impromptu exchange in front of a new American video camera that caught the leaders on tape. They also engaged in a boastful debate about the standard of living in their two countries as they stood in front of a model American kitchen, assessing the latest appliances. On a memorable trip down the Moscow River on a 25-foot motor launch, Khrushchev mocked Nixon's assertion that the people of the communist bloc lived under slavery by shouting to startled picnickers and bathers, "Are you captives? Are you slaves?" He roared with laughter as they replied, "Niet, niet." Nixon duly reported back to Eisenhower the details of his visit, which he wrote with Nixonian embellishment, "can only be described as an extraordinary experience." In his 1962 book, Six Crises, Nixon sought to heighten the significance of the trip. He depicted his long one-on-one sessions with Khrushchev as monumental clashes of will between two tough and unforgiving combatants. Khrushchev, he wrote, was always on the offensive, always aggressive, rude, and forceful, always probing for weaknesses. Nixon described himself as on edge, keyed up, and ready for battle. But since he was the guest, he had to avoid making any rude remarks in reply to Khrushchev's provocations. "I had to counter him like a fighter with one hand tied behind his back." Nixon fought by Marquess of Queensberry rules, while Khrushchev punched like a bare-knuckle slugger. The two men went toe-to-toe. It was cold steel between us. It was hand-to-hand combat. And so on. Khrushchev would later refer to Nixon as a son of a bitch, a puppet of McCarthy, and an unprincipled puppet, which is the most dangerous kind. So perhaps Nixon did manage to rattle the Soviet leader. Nixon's trip served him well. He received praise from the press for his handling of Khrushchev. According to James Reston, the trip enhanced Mr. Nixon's chances of nomination for president by the Republican Party in 1960. In Russia, Nixon had found a more complex and dynamic society than he had expected. He had effectively spoken out about American freedom of religion and the press, and done so in a manner that was firm but respectful. Reston concluded that Nixon had handled a delicate political assignment with considerable skill. Even Walter Lippmann praised him for demonstrating that personal diplomacy could be far more effective in lowering world tensions than meetings of professional diplomats. Voters too took notice. In August and September, the Gallup poll showed Nixon leading both Adlai Stevenson and John Kennedy in a presidential contest by 2 points. Eisenhower approved of Nixon's performance, but he did not want to let the spotlight linger on his junior partner. On August 3rd, while Nixon was concluding his tour with a brief stop in Poland and basking in the adulation of large crowds in Warsaw, Eisenhower made even bigger news. In a hastily prepared press conference, Eisenhower announced that he would welcome Khrushchev to the United States within a matter of weeks and would travel to the USSR by the end of the year. Giant headlines filled the world's newspapers. The exchange of visits was the biggest news story since Sputnik. The Soviet Union remained for many Americans a frightening and menacing country. Stalin had been dead for only 6 years, and memories of Soviet tanks in Budapest and Khrushchev's nuclear saber rattling over Suez still burned. Yet Ike put out a hand of peace and invited the Soviets to grasp it. The announcement marked a turning point for Eisenhower. The doldrums of the post-election defeat lifted. New air filled the sails of the ship of state. His approval rating, which had slumped to 52% in November 1958, now hit 64%, according to the Gallup poll. The Wall Street Journal hailed Ike's new personal diplomacy as a sharp turn in the conduct of foreign affairs. Reston wrote that Eisenhower seemed reborn, a man of action again, moving and planning and speaking out with a new serenity. He has moved out of the shadows and into the center of the stage. With the restraining figures of Sherman Adams and John Foster Dulles gone, Eisenhower seemed more flexible, dynamic, determined to secure his legacy. "He sees the light at the end of the tunnel," Reston observed, "and some of the old sparkle has returned." Ann Whitman, who saw the president every day and knew his moods well, described him as happy as a lad about the news that he and Khrushchev would exchange visits. Instead of frosty, tense arguments over Berlin and nuclear weapons, carried out by tired, faceless bureaucrats in Geneva, Eisenhower proposed to melt a little bit of the ice that seems to freeze our relationship, as he said at his news conference. Americans overwhelmingly approved. If anyone had the prestige and stature to thaw the Cold War, it was Eisenhower. 5. Planning for Khrushchev's visit began immediately. On August 5th, Eisenhower debriefed Nixon, who provided some churlish comments. Khrushchev, he said, had a closed mind and was primitive and polemical. Nixon suggested that the State Department arrange long meetings with Khrushchev to tire him out and ferret out his main points before he met with Eisenhower, so as to put him at a disadvantage, precisely the tactic to which Nixon had been subjected. From the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, Ambassador Llewellyn Tommy Thompson, who had replaced Chip Bohlen in 1957, cabled Eisenhower with more thoughtful advice. Khrushchev, he reminded Ike, was a true believer in communism and in the inevitable collapse of capitalism. If organized correctly, the trip might shake his convictions that America was a feeble, rotten society. The trip should demonstrate the long-term prospects for growth of the vast American economy. If Khrushchev was forced to confront the reality of American power and industry, he might prove more amenable at the conference table. Eisenhower reiterated to his advisers that while he did not anticipate any major breakthrough with Khrushchev, he wanted to bring about some lessening of tension and some measure of confidence and relief to the minds of our people. In a revealing phrase, he told Staff Secretary Andrew Goodpaster that he thought he personally might make an appeal to Khrushchev in terms of his place in history by taking steps to ease the Cold War. He planned to warm him up by hosting him both at Gettysburg and at Camp David in an informal setting where the two could try to move beyond stale ideological arguments. One crucial preliminary task awaited before Ike met with the Soviet leader. He had to reassure his NATO allies that the United States did not intend to negotiate any grand bargain in the Cold War or sell out West Germany by agreeing to Khrushchev's demands. To make his point, in late summer, Eisenhower conducted a hasty tour of three capital cities, Bonn, London, and Paris. On August 26th, he set off for West Germany and was met by Chancellor Konrad Adenauer and by an enormous crowd lining the streets of the capital city, a heartwarming welcome for the man who only